You are listening to Making Bank, where we uncover the mindset and success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business.
Welcome to Making Bank. I am Josh Felber, where we uncover the mindset and the success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business today. Super excited and honored for today's guest. Guys, get your pen and paper ready. Make sure you're paying attention and really taking notes for this. This is going to be an amazing show today. I'm excited to have Samson Jagoras. He is the founder of Growth View Properties and the founder of Passive Growth Group. Samson Jagoras helped give others access to investments that they thought were unattainable and acts as a liaison, educator, and curator that gives them supreme confidence in their passive multifamily investments. Over his 13-year career in business, executive leadership, and entrepreneurship, Samson has served as a futures and commodities broker, actively invested in real estate, became a commercial real estate broker, became the VP of strategic investments for RE/MAX Commercial Alliance. He has also built several businesses and acted as chief strategy officer at Madwire, an Inc. 500 company. After 9 years of scaling Madwire's revenues from $7 million to over $100 million and 35 employees to 600 employees, he walked away from his high-income position to go all in on helping everyday investors put their money to work in large commercial apartment investments. So I'm super excited to welcome Samson Jagoras to Making Bank today.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm pumped.
Yeah, for sure. Super cool about your background a little bit is back in when I was in high school and everything, I did a lot with investments and we had like an investment class. And this was, early 80s. So it was and USA Today and AT&T had sponsored a contest. And they give you like fictitious money, but you traded in real time. So I did all this trading and ended up placing like first out of like 20,000 people. And I've always done investment stuffs and options and everything over the years. And so it's commodities and all these things. When I was introing you, I was like, oh, that's awesome.
So, I know it's rare that people even know what a commodity or a futures contract is. But
it's all Bitcoin and crypto these days.
Yeah, I mean, I went to school and got a degree in human physiology. I thought I was going to become an orthopedic surgeon, but playing football and trying to go to school and get a degree in physiology, my grades pretty much decided for me that I wasn't going to be an orthopedic surgeon. I was an average student at best, but I didn't even know what a commodity was. Thankfully, my father-in-law, he spent 30 years in that industry.
Oh, wow.
And so he... as I was making my exit out, he said, hey, I think you'd be pretty good at this. And I'm like, I went to school for physiology. Like, I don't know anything about this. He's like, don't worry. Like, you just need to be good on the phone. You need to be relentless, gritty, competitive, and you can go get a Series 3. And once you pass that test, then you can be a broker and I'll teach you everything that I know. So he had been through the savings and loan crisis. He'd been through the dot-com bubble. And so he just knew that it was a very lucrative career, you know, having that skill set of being able to identify good investments and trades and then just being personable, charismatic. He thought I'd be pretty good at it. Well, I'm thankful for that opportunity because it pretty much changed my whole trajectory. So,
yeah. And that's super cool because you started to learn that younger, you know, in just out of school and stuff, it sounds like. So,
yeah, I graduated on a Friday with a degree in human physiology and I walked into a futures and commodities brokerage on a Monday. And 3 months later, September 29th, 2008, the Dow Jones fell 777 points in a single day. Economic housing crisis kicked off and I got baptized. But when you have nothing to lose because you don't have anything, you know, it was cool for me. It was a great experience. And, I watched some people do really well and some people get their head handed to them. But I'm very blessed and grateful for that opportunity because it really set up my whole path for investing. You know, I talked to some people today that are my same age. I'm 36. And they really just don't know anything about investing or how to put their money to work to help them make more money, you know?
For sure. What were some of the kind of the keys that you took away from that you've applied now to your investments and what you're teaching and everything?
You know, everything you do is ultimately an investment, right? So you're just looking for the ultimate ROI. You know, I think a lot of times when entrepreneurs are scaling a company or a business, they really hold on to all the things, right? Because, well, if I spend money on that... right. Well, how am I going to pay myself or pay my bills or I can do it? And the best I ever heard it was, you know, is this a $10 an hour task or is this a $10,000 an hour task? And you kind of need to decide between, hey, making that investment in this content creator or this marketer or this employee is going to return huge dividends, because if I get my time back, man, what can I do with that exponentially, right? Because time is ultimately money. So going through that, going through 2008, learning how to pivot a company in the middle of all that, the whole industry got turned on its head at the same time. Real-time quotes were coming out. So, you know, as a broker, it used to be your customer would call you, call down to the floor, see what's happening with gold or whatever it may be. And then you'd call your customer and they'd tell you, place a trade, and you get paid $40 every time somebody does that. Well, when real-time quotes came out and the business went from that to anybody can trade for $5 and you don't really need a broker anymore, we had to pivot to doing more managed money. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, in the middle of that, in the middle of 2008, the CEO, after being in that business for 35 years, was like, man, I'm pretty burnt out. We should go pivot and start a new company. There's no time like the present, a recession, to start a new company.
Sure.
And so then we spun up Madwire and ended up scaling that thing over the last 10 years.
That's awesome. And so what, kind of give us a little concept of what Madwire was about for anybody that doesn't know.
Yeah. So at the time, you know, Google was still kind of coming about. There was a ton of custom website going on, website design going on. So people could pay $150 an hour to get a website built, and 100 hours later, voila, he had a website. Well, we could see, right, you know, that that marketing was really going to be the driver, as like things like Wix and Squarespace and web.com were coming around the corner. You know, website design was becoming pretty well commoditized. So there was a huge demand for it in the market. So we started off as a marketing company, got some great opportunities, partnered up with a company called BigCommerce. We were their lead designer for a really long time. But, you know, we have one singular partner and that company scaling up. And then you see Shopify and all these other companies kind of coming up. So it really pivoted the business to start doing a lot more marketing. So we were doing managed services and managed marketing for, gosh, 5-7 years. And then I came in to run the marketing product and really scale that up. And then we started building out marketing technology and a marketing platform and all that good stuff. And then went through a couple acquisitions, and I pretty much ran my road as far as I could possibly take it. You know, I'm a builder. I like building things. And right, you know, when you get up to 600 people, it starts to get a little bit more corporate. And I just couldn't contribute or make the impact in the way that I could anymore. And that's okay. We're still rock and roller. I'm still a shareholder. So things are still good. But yeah.
That's awesome. So what was it like? I mean, obviously going from like 30-something employees to over 600 employees, there's lots of different sets of dynamics along that journey. When you hit 50 or 100, when you hit a couple hundred, and, you know, kind of fill us in on that.
So imagine you're driving down the highway going 90 and your hair's on fire. That's kind of what it feels like. You know, it's what got you there won't get you there. And so, you know, what worked with 35 doesn't work with 100, and what 100 doesn't work with 600. And so Sure. Even the dynamics of bringing, you know, new employees and integrating them into the company, you know, at one point we were hiring at a clip at about 150 people a year. And wow. So it constantly changes. As the ship gets bigger, it gets less and less nimble.
Right.
And those are some of the biggest challenges that you overcome, because, you know, you have 300, 400 people you're responsible for. You don't want to really rock the boat and shift too much, but man, technology moves so quickly and marketing moves so quickly that you have to be constantly pivoting, and that can be a major challenge when you're that big. And so we tried to stay small as we possibly could and as nimble and as minimal bureaucracy as possible. But sometimes it's just inevitable. As you get bigger, you need to really put in chain of command and really learn how to put key people in places that can drive the business or certain arms of the business, you know, the direction you need to go.
You know, with kind of that scaling of the tech company, I mean, through the acquisitions and everything, what was, some of your guys' biggest challenges that you had to look to overcome with that?
Yeah, when you're growing quickly, you don't have a lot of time to train as effectively as you probably want to, right?
Sure.
And sometimes you're scaling and hiring for stuff that's not fully formed yet. And so you're building a lot of stuff as you go. And I think that's, you know, the beautiful thing about entrepreneurship is, as you kind of build this, you build your parachute on the way down is kind of the way to go, to sleep and build your parachute on the way down. But I think a lot of people get into business and they get stuck. If you've ever read the book, The E-Myth, right, by Michael Gerber, they get stuck building themselves a job, right? And they're not thinking about how to scale themselves out of this position. If you're an entrepreneur, that role that you're in right now is always temporary, because you need to go build the next one and the next one. So you need to be documenting, building processes. And those are some of the things that kind of fall to the wayside as you're scaling. And so that was a big part of what my job was, as we were sitting in a meeting when we were first getting ready to scale up, and they said, hey, we're going to hire 60 people. And I was like, how are we going to train them? And they were like, yeah, we'll figure it out. Don't worry about it. And I'm like, that's a bad idea. So I walked out like not really knowing what I was doing and just started trying to create some semblance of a training program. You know what I mean? And then that led to me hiring, and then that led to me leading the team. And so it's, I think the biggest takeaway is you want to document early and often. It can be arduous and time consuming, but in the grand scheme of things, it allows you to hand off that task to somebody else so that you can go focus on the more important stuff.
Yeah, no, that's definitely super important. I know I'm kind of like that. It's like, yeah, it's hire. Sure, we'll figure it out along the way.
But hiring's a huge cost. I mean, it costs like $30,000 to get one employee. And think the churn ripple effect every time you lose an employee. I mean, and the knowledge loss and all that time that goes into doing that. I mean, it's not just $30,000. It's probably hundreds of thousands of dollars in the grand scheme of things.
Definitely. Yeah. That's why it's like awesome to have, you know, somebody that's like, cool, you know, we got to have the system, we got to have the, you know, the training, we got to have this, you know, and putting these things in place. Cause a lot of times you got the people that are that quick start driving. And then you kind of need that other part that's like, all right, here's the foundation. Here's the systems that everybody's got to kind of fall into as we're scaling, you know, adding 60 more people.
Yeah. The best entrepreneurs that I know are pragmatic idealists. So they're really good at like looking down the road and seeing here's where we got to go, but they understand the reality of where they're at. Mm-hmm. If you're too idealistic, you're going to leave a shitstorm behind you, you know, of all the people, because you get it, right? So you just expect everybody else to get it too. And that's generally not the case. If you're too pragmatic and you don't have any, you can't ever look to the future and you don't want to get uncertain, uncomfortable and change things, you're really going to struggle, you know? So if you're an idealist, then you need to find a good pragmatic partner who can like crush it on processes. And if you're too pragmatic, then you need to find a good futuristic type of visionary to really lead the company, because if you ain't growing, you're dying, you know?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I think that's a good way to look at it, because a lot of times we get all caught up and we're like, cool, you know, vision, you know, goals, here's where we're going. And then we don't have that other piece of it.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, at the end of the day, I call it the getting hit by a bus theory, right? It's like, if I'm driving home tomorrow and I get hit by a bus, can this business keep operating without me? If I hold on the knowledge in my head, that's not a very scalable company at all, right? You're not building an asset at that point. You're not building something that can grow and be sold. And why do you get into entrepreneurship? Sure, it's incredibly lucrative, but I know where you're coming from. We share similar beliefs. It's about getting your time back, right? And so if you can't ever get your time back because you've never built a process or a system that doesn't actually need you, then you don't have a business. You just have a glorified job.
Yep. Yeah, 100%. Awesome. So you left Madwire and went out on your adventure, and is that kind of moving into the real estate that you're into now, or what is that?
Yeah, so I started investing in 2011, been doing that pretty successfully. Okay. I'm doing some brokerage now, commercial brokerage. I never really did it with the intention of being a broker. You know, really where I love to work is on the development side and the syndication side, so structuring deals and putting those deals together. And so I support the team with RE/MAX Commercial on how to put those deals together, is how to raise money. There's a lot that goes into it, because when you step into the world of like syndicating deals, you're falling under the SEC compliance. And so it's a whole new dynamic that a lot of people are afraid of or don't know how to navigate. But ultimately, my favorite thing to do is to just help people take their money and put it to work. You know, one of the reasons that I stuck at Madwire as long as I did is because I had equity in the business, and I would never have stuck as long as I did if I didn't have equity. Cause in order to build true wealth, you got to have equity in something. Getting a job, having a W-2, that's only a means to an end, but you need to find ways to parlay that equity into something else. And so most people love this idea of real estate. Then they read the webinars, the podcasts, they do the books and they study. And then they realize like, oh crap, this is an actual business. Like I have to go start another business. And maybe they're already crushing it in their career. Maybe they're already crushing it in their business. And they don't necessarily have the bandwidth to go and put their money to work, right? If my roof was leaking, I could fix it. or I could just call a roofer, right?
Right.
And the same thing kind of goes for real estate. Is there's this misconception that you have to be in control of the whole asset in order to have all the benefits that come along with owning real estate. People want real estate because you get the cash flow, the appreciation, the loan pay down, right? And the tax benefits that come with that, the depreciation. Well, you can passively invest and get the same, if not better, returns into a larger, more scalable asset class and get all those benefits without any of the brain damage, and you can just keep focusing on crushing it in your business, right? And doing what you're skilled at or good at. Now, a lot of people that go that route eventually, you know, they want to get into it more actively, but let's face it, what we're all really chasing at the end of the day is time. And right. So every dollar that you make is future time that you need to go put out there and put to work, and whether that's stocks or e-commerce business or your side hustle or buying real estate or investing passively, you know, that you got to be building equity, and ultimately you got to be building cash flow so that you don't necessarily have to work if you don't want to. And so that's the thing that gets me juiced up. You know, that's the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning. I get super excited for that. You know, I grew up in a blue collar family where money was just really hard to come by. And my parents just didn't have a concept of that. They don't really still really struggle with this concept of like putting your money to work and sure. using that to create more money. And so I was fortunate to have some really good mentors. And I learned really early on, you know, when I was a commodities broker in 2008, the people that were, you know, really successful and sending me $500,000 checks were the ones that were entrepreneurs and business owners who knew how to leverage their money and make more money. You know what I mean? So I've just been obsessed with that. I can't say that I know everything, but damn, I sure do try. And I surround myself with a bunch of people who are way smarter than I am. And
sure.
And now we're just raising capital, and we travel across the country looking for good investment opportunities. And we work with, you know, private and money investors, family offices, joint venture partners to just take down large commercial apartment complexes.
That's awesome. So then you're putting the deals together for these large apartment complexes. So if I was like, hey, you know, I want to put some money in, and then it would, I could invest into one of the deals that you're structuring.
You got it. Exactly right. So it's kind of the path that people go is they think about investing in real estate, and then they think that I don't have the time, I don't have the money, I don't have the expertise, I don't have the most money to get access to the best deals. So once they kind of discover that that's the case, they're at this crossroads of which I do is keep doing traditional investing, low barrier of entry stocks, which give you no equity ultimately because you're a 1099, so you don't get all the other benefits to go along with owning the asset. Mm-hmm. You don't get any of the depreciation, which knocks down your taxable income. Or do I go the route of being a passive investor? So the people that go the route of being a passive investor, well, there's still another learning curve, right? They don't know what internal rate of return is. They don't understand how to pick a good sponsor, a good market. They don't understand how the whole industry works, how the debt and the capital and the equity all comes together. And so the other part of my business is I focus on just creating education around how to be a sophisticated passive investor, like how to critically analyze a deal, because there's tons of great sponsors out there. And whether you invest with me or you invest with somebody else, well, that in itself is a skill set. And that's what the wealthy people understand that most middle-class people don't understand is wealthy people deploy their capital with other really smart people. And that's how they get wealthier. They don't try to do everything themselves, but what they do know how to do is they know how to critically analyze investments and opportunities and then strategically place capital into those deals.
For sure. What were kind of like the top three things that when you're looking at an investment opportunity like that you should look for?
Well, I mean, I think the very first thing is you should understand why you want to be in a market. So a lot of people, you know, when they're investing, they'll think in their backyard because it's comfortable, it's easy for them to understand. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the best place to invest. So then maybe they'll jump on LoopNet or something like that, and they'll start looking at opportunities. And how do they sort? They sort by price, right?
Well, right.
Just because something's in range for you doesn't necessarily mean that it's better, right? So the very first thing you got to understand is, why do I want to be in this market? Because if not, and you're looking at it in a vacuum, confirmation bias sets in and you'll start convincing yourself of why this is a good deal and why it makes sense, right? It's like, if you know, why would you pick Kansas City over Denver? Why would you pick Denver over Austin? You know, if you can't compare those cities on a relative scale, then you're not actually thinking clearly or straight on why you want to do it. So that's kind of like the first thing. And then, you know, once you get into the deal, you're always looking for what's the, you know, what's what's the delta? What's the opportunity for me to actually add value? Now, there's a million ways to make $1 million in real estate. And as you grow up and you become more wealthy, you know, you're worried a little bit more about capital preservation and less about equity growth. But if you understand just the P&L and you understand that businesses are valued off of their net operating income, well, buying an asset like a multifamily apartment complex is you're just buying the business. So you're looking at the balance sheet and you're going, where can I add value? Where's the little tweak? Can I improve rents? Can I do this renovation plan? Can I put in a better property manager? And if I can do that, based off of what the capitalization rate is, I can improve the value or the equity of that property, you know? And then, the very last thing is you just want to always know what your exit plan is before you get into it. You know, it's
okay.
Sometimes people buy real estate with this, infinite mindset. I'm going to hold it forever. Sure. I've hold a lot of real estate forever, but at a certain point you can upgrade that or move that money into something that's better, that drives even more return and continue to grow, leveraging some of the tax code. I think a lot of people don't realize this, but we're in a capitalistic society. So the government relies on us to do two things: create jobs and create housing. And if you do those two things, you receive the maximum benefits of the tax code. Mm-hmm. And so being a real estate investor and using things like the 1031 exchange in order to trade up into a larger or better asset ultimately means you can defer the taxes and kick the can down the road. And the longer that you can do that, the quicker that nest egg will grow.
Yeah, no, that's good for sure. I know we got a few minutes left. What, out of kind of like working with different mentors over the years and everything, what were kind of like, I know we got time is super important, buying back time, but what would you say your next top two or three kind of success strategies or ideas or tips that you have?
My number one success strategy is partnerships. Mm. In any deal, whether it's real estate or any business, there's essentially five players, and you might play multiple roles, but you need somebody to find the deal or find the opportunity. Okay. You need somebody to make it viable. You need somebody to be able to get the deal over the line. You need somebody to bring the money or raise the money, and you need somebody to sell it on the back end. So when we're looking at a project, you know, if this is 100% of the equity, this pie, and somebody brings the deal, but they don't have any of the knowledge on how to get it over the line, well, sure, that entitles them to 20% of the equity in the deal. But if I have all the other expertise, right, then I deserve the other 80% of that equity. Sure. But that ultimately means that you can build wealth and equity in things by just being good at one aspect. Like maybe you're just an incredible deal finder and you find a great deal and you bring it to somebody and you say, I have this deal. I have it under contract. I don't have any of the money. I don't have any of the other expertise to get it over the line, but I know that you do. All I'm asking for in exchange is X, right? And okay. So it's a way for you to create wealth in real estate without necessarily having to have the money. You know, so partnerships is definitely crucial. You know, when we're doing development projects, there's so many challenges: entitlement, converting raw land into something that you can build on, sewer, water, electrical, utilities. I don't know all that, but my engineer buddy who spent 40 years doing that, who's now a development consultant, can do it in his sleep.
Right.
You know what he doesn't know how to do? He doesn't know how to go to raise money, right? Boom. That's a partnership right there. And together we can go build something awesome. But too many people try to be solopreneurs and try to do everything on them by themselves. And not only is it daunting, I mean, you're an entrepreneur, you know this, but you're just not equipped to do it all by yourself. It's just impossible.
Yeah, for sure. No, that's awesome. I think those are two huge, huge, important, tips, you know, for sure. Guys, I hope you guys are really listening to what Samson's been talking about today, taking notes. Go back, watch this again, rewind, listen to it, and pay attention to some of the things that he's dropping throughout the interview. It's going to help you elevate wherever you are right now in your business, in your personal life, and then start applying those today. Where can people get more information on you, Samson?
Yeah, if you want to learn more about how to passively invest in commercial real estate and multifamily, you can head over to passiveinvesting.pro. There's a good master course over there, and there's also some special little treats for you guys to just learn more about how to put your money to work into multifamily real estate. And if you want to follow up with me, you can always DM me directly. Instagram, LinkedIn are all great places to hang out.
Awesome. Well, really appreciate your time today. One last thing before we go. What's one thing you're like, oh man, I was hoping Josh was going to ask me this, but he didn't ask it to me. So I really want to let everybody know.
Man, you put me on the spot here. What do I do for fun?
There we go. What do you do for fun? Cool.
What I do for fun is I love to exercise. I built a really badass gym. We got about 300 members, and opportunity awesome. Kind of landed in our lap. I had another good partner, and we came up with this crazy idea. And we built 4 years ago. We built a pretty awesome training facility, about 7,000 square feet, and we help a lot of people just stay in shape and get in shape and change people's lives in that way too. So that's something that I'm super passionate about. I decided to finally use my physiology degree after 10 years of not using it. So.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, I used to have a few CrossFit gyms and stuff myself too.
So oh, cool.
Definitely loved being in that space and everything, so that's awesome. Well, cool, guys. Go check out Samson, and really appreciate your time today. You guys were watching Making Bank. Get out and be extraordinary.
Thank you for listening to Making Bank. If you have enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And sharing is caring. Follow Josh Felber on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram for more. You can also listen to Making Bank on Amazon Alexa, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and watch on Apple TV, Success Thinkers Network, Amazon Fire, and YouTube.